All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome back to Making the Arguments. We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to be talking about some of the headlines that showed up in the news, things like minimum wage, voting rights, defunding the police, abolition of the prison system, as well as a host of other issues dealing with the stimulus package, etc. But what we're going to do is we're actually going to look at the arguments that were made, and we're going to apply what we talked about in the previous episode. So the last episode, if you haven't listened to it yet, we talked about how to use good critical thinking, the laws of logic, how to identify some of the tactics that are commonly used, and how to effectively respond to it, right? And responding to it starts with understanding how they're wording their argument. You know, what sort of not only debate tactics are they using, but what sort of wording are they using? What does it imply, and how does it actually set up the argument in the first place? So let's go ahead and dive right into that. The first thing I want to talk about, there were some articles through CNN, MSNBC, and we're going to go through a couple of those. One had to do with an article that was written by Dean Obadiah talking about the GOP assaulting voters' rights, right? It was the assault on voting rights by the GOP. And again, what's interesting to look at within this article is that if you look at the legislation that a lot of state legislatures have passed, because again, most of your voting law is not at the federal level, it's at the state level with respect to, you know, mail-in voting or voting absentee. What are the rules? How early can you vote? This is state law, it's not federal law. And by the way, you don't want it to be federal law, right? There's certain general guidelines that obviously provide protections through the U.S. Constitution, but ultimately you do want your states to be the ones making this sort of law that deals with the nuances of voting. And again, the overall goal for voting should be twofold, right? One fold should be we want to make sure that we ensure access, right? We don't want any sort of limitations. The Democratic Party during the Jim Crow era put in a lot of things like poll taxes, poll tests, and they were specifically utilized for racist purposes in order to suppress African-American voters, right? So access to the ballot is very, very important. We want to make sure that it is relatively easy for anyone that is legally able to vote to be able to cast a ballot. The other thing that you really want with voting laws is to make sure that you're protecting the integrity of the election, which is to say that you're putting reasonable measures in place in order to prevent voter fraud, right? In order to prevent someone from voting who's not legally permitted to, because that's ultimately another form of voter suppression. Every time somebody casts an illegal ballot, it essentially has the potential to negate a legally cast ballot. So it is another form of voter suppression, not only because it affects the outcome of a particular election, but it also causes people to lose faith in the process overall. So those are the two pillars upon which voting rights really stands: access and integrity. Now, if you look at a lot of the laws that have been put forward by the legislatures, by Republican-controlled state legislatures, here's what they generally focus on. They usually have rules with respect to absentee balloting. So for instance, it wasn't that long ago here in Virginia that if you wanted to cast an absentee ballot, you needed to have a signature of a witness saying that, yes, it is this person who has cast that ballot. Early voting, we used to not have early voting that was like several weeks ahead of the election. There were still early voting opportunities, but it was closer to the actual election. You also now have these new laws in generally Democrat-controlled states where they have ballot drop-off boxes. And obviously, there's some concerns with how do you monitor that and make sure that you don't have people stuffing the boxes with illegal ballots and things of that nature. One of the other big laws that you generally see from Republican legislatures has to do with voter ID. Now, we're going to talk about this from the integrity and the access part. I support voter ID provided that the government is providing you with a voter ID, right? If the government's not actually providing you with a photo ID that you can use to then go and vote, then it becomes a suppression issue, right? But it, provided that you have a photo ID provided by the government, then it's not that big a demand on someone to say, hey, look, we just want some proof that you are who you say you are. And again, every time we come up with voter ID laws, Democrats automatically accuse us of trying to engage in voter suppression. There was actually a really interesting man on the street set of interviews that was done not that long ago, where you had all of these left-wing college students and politicians suggesting that photo ID was a deliberate attempt to suppress minority voting. And then they went into a predominantly minority neighborhood and asked them about photo ID. And of course, all of them were like, no, everyone's got a photo ID. You got to have a photo ID. Well, where do you get a photo ID? Oh, you just go down, you know, to the DMV over on 3rd Street and get it. So again, it's kind of this false narrative that a lot of times is put out that if there is a photo ID requirement, even when the government is providing it free of charge, that somehow that is a deliberate attempt at voter suppression, right? And that's what was interesting, is that if you look at the legislation that the author of this article was referencing, that's largely what it was. It was just talking about common sense measures that have typically been in place in order to ensure the integrity of the vote without putting a great deal of burden on any legal voter to be able to get the necessary identification or whatever it was in order to vote. But you notice how he writes the article, right? It's the GOP assault on voting rights. And the reason why he's using that terminology is because he's setting you up as you look at the article to where you don't even feel, you know, the inclination to go and actually check what the legislation is, because obviously the author of this news article has already said that this is the GOP trying to suppress voting rights. So right off the bat, right? You have a protagonist and you have an antagonist. The protagonist is the person that wants to protect voting rights, and the antagonists are all of the GOP people that are trying to suppress voting rights. But that's why it's important to kind of read, you know, between the lines. But because the language he's using is deliberate. He's trying to set up the viewer to have a presupposition, right, or an underlying assumption about what's going on. And that was a big focus of what we talked about last podcast, right, is challenging assumptions. So what actually makes something an assault on voting rights? Well, according to this author, it's pretty much any sort of I don't even want to say restriction, but any sort of legal mechanism you would put in place in order to try to ensure the integrity of the vote, or at least from a broad sweeping angle, automatically, he equates it to voter suppression. And again, it's a common tactic that's used. We see it in the Virginia General Assembly all the time. Anytime we have anything that says, hey, look, maybe we should investigate this, maybe we should have, you know, some restrictions in there to make sure that when someone votes, we know it's you know, the legally qualified person to vote, it's instantly, you're just engaging in voter suppression. And then they don't have to actually, you know, come back with any sort of comprehensive argument, because they've already established you're a bad person. Right? It's not, I disagree with your policy and here's why. It's, you're a bad person, and so therefore your policy position must be bad. Right? So a real common example of that. And you're going to see a lot more of this, because there's a lot of people that are concerned about election integrity. And the left's argument is, well, yeah, you're only concerned about it because Donald Trump told you to be concerned about it. Well, no, there are relevant things to be concerned about. We have seen instances of voter fraud all over the country. Now, am I claiming that voter fraud accounts for all the election results? No, I'm not saying anything like that. But any instance of voter fraud is still fraud, and it should certainly be addressed, because if you don't address that sort of fraud, and in some way you encourage it to continue to take place, and putting in reasonable measures to make it more difficult to engage in voter fraud without taking away a legal voter's opportunity or ability to vote and to vote easily, right? There's nothing wrong with that. So we, again, you're going to see a lot of this in headlines talking about any sort of legislation along these lines being a GOP attempt to suppress the vote or an assault on voting rights. It's garbage. Go look at the history of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party with respect to voting rights, and you tell me, you know, which party has a better track record. Let's move on to the next issue. This is another one that I loved. It was an article in the MSNBC, and they were talking about forgiving college debt. And the author was obviously, and the whole debate was, it wasn't even really a debate on whether or not we should, quote, forgive college debt. It was a debate on, should it be $10,000 of college debt, federal loans, or should it be $50,000 in college debt? And the whole debate was about whether or not Joe Biden possessed the power within the Constitution to just forgive it by executive order. And even Joe Biden recognized that that might have been a bridge too far and it was going to have to go through the legislature in order to accomplish that. And they all wanted to forgive up to $50,000 in college loan, but they're saying that, well, we might be at a point where we have to settle for $10,000. Now, again, we can get into the debate all day long on whether or not the president has the power to do that through executive order. We can get into the debate on whether $10,000 is appropriate or $50,000 is appropriate. Here's what I want to do, right? Going back to that underlying assumption, what's the presupposition? When they use the term forgive college debt, all right, they're automatically putting it into our minds that this is something that the executive branch or that the federal government in general can simply forgive, right? And when you think forgive, you think, oh, it's just gone. No, you cannot forgive that sort of debt because it was paid for by taxpayer dollars. It would be one thing if an individual said to you that, hey, I know I loaned you some money, but you know what? It's fine. You don't got to pay it back. All right, they're forgiving that debt in the sort of way that we generally think of it, which is to say that the person that actually issued the debt or the person that actually provided the loan is assuming the responsibility by telling you don't got to pay it back, right? So maybe they suffer a financial consequence as a result of not paying it back. You clearly don't, and nobody else does because nobody else was involved in that transaction between the person that took the debt and the person that provided the funds for it. But when we're talking about the federal government forgiving college loan debt, it was the taxpayers that paid it, right? So everybody, whether you went to college, whether you didn't go to college, whether you ever intend to go to college, if you chose to do something entirely different with your life with respect to your educational and career path, let's say you got out of high school and you went to a trade school, or let's say you took some sort of other method. Let's say you went to college, but you worked really hard to get good scholarships and you worked your way through college the whole time. And so you didn't rack up a bunch of debt and whatever debt you did do, you paid it off. You are now paying for the debt of everyone that took the college loan, right? Took it knowing that they would have to pay it back and are now coming back to the government and saying, well, you know, I don't want to pay it. So they're not forgiving anything. They are transferring the responsibility of paying back that debt from the college student, from the person that took out the debt, onto all of the taxpayers that didn't take on the debt. And not only is this wrong from just like a moral and justice position, right? Why should you be forced to pay back a loan you didn't take? I want you to think about the sort of incentive structure that creates. You're creating a scenario where politicians who are, you know, very happy to hand out tax dollars to people in order to entice them to vote for them, right? They're now just handing it out. And then when it comes time to pay it back so that we can actually, you know, work toward balancing our budget, they say, oh, no big deal. Yeah, exactly. Because that politician doesn't pay an individual economic price for, quote, forgiving that debt, right? But you as the taxpayer do. And that's why we should be furious about this. Is because, you know, not only is it fiscally irresponsible, not only is it really unjust on just a basic moral level, but it also incentivizes really, really bad spending practices from our politicians when they can continue to pretend that that is their debt to forgive, right? They forgave that debt on behalf of all of us as taxpayers. And that is really problematic. And again, it creates a perverse incentive with those that are taking loans, because now in the future, if we say, hey, you're going to take a loan, someone is now taking that and they're factoring into their own decision. Not just, am I going to have to pay this back, but they're factoring their decision. Well, you know what? I can take this money and maybe I'll take more money than I otherwise would have, because after all, the politicians with enough pressure are just going to, you know, give it up in the first place. And there's another thing I want to segue really quickly into here with respect to college prices. You know, the federal government getting into the college loan business was presumably because, you know, they wanted more people to go to college and college is expensive. Okay, great. So has college become less expensive as a result of all these federal loans? Absolutely not. The prices have skyrocketed. Why? Because those universities know they're going to get their money so they can increase rates. Not only can they increase the price or the tuition of going to college, but now they don't even really have to compete the way that they used to within the loan market for education. Because when you're seeking a private loan in order to go to education, I guarantee you that bank is not going to come back and say, you know what, don't worry about it. Why? Because the bank was investing, right, the depositor's money. And they know that they have an obligation to get that money back in order to pay back their depositors. And so if a bank's going to loan you money, they're not only going to ask whether or not you're a good student, they're also going to ask some really important questions like, what do you intend to major in? Because I guarantee you, if you're majoring in, you know, I don't know, dance theory, the probability you're going to be able to pay back that loan is incredibly low. And so they're probably not going to give you a loan to go to college to spend 4 years on a dance theory degree, right? But if the college knows that the money's coming from the federal government and basically if a student applies, they're going to get it. Well, now the college's incentive structure has changed as well, because now they have an incentive to just provide all these fluff courses that they can charge premium rates for, regardless of whether or not it's actually going to help you get a job in the end. And then they'll come back and lobby the federal government to forgive the loan because, hey, they got paid. So that's really what this is. This is a massive wealth transfer, not only from people that didn't take out a loan to people that did take out a loan. It's a massive wealth transfer to the university system. Right. And so this is just problematic on so many levels. And again, we have every right to be furious with it because it is totally unfair, especially to the people, not that just didn't take out a loan, but chose a different path because they wanted to be more economically viable or chose to go to college, but did so in a financially responsible way and worked their way through. You've just told all of the kids that worked really hard to get through college that, you know what, you shouldn't have bothered. You shouldn't have bothered. Because, you know, mommy and daddy government are going to pay for it for you. That is totally irresponsible and unjust on so many levels. Let's talk about another article that was, that just kind of blew my mind. And it was around two things, all right? One was defunding the police, and one was what they call abolition of the prison system, right? So it's basically, it's a movement to get rid of all prisons. Now, look, if your goal is to achieve a position in society where prisons are no longer necessary because people aren't engaging in violence, they're not defrauding people, that there's essentially no longer a reason to segregate an offender from their victims or from other people that they could potentially victimize, great, I am with you. I want to live in that society. I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think we're going to be there tomorrow, right? So, But you listen to the language that they're using when they talk about getting rid of the prison system, right? They talk about the abolition movement. And this came from a woman named Miriam Kaba. And this is what she says. She goes, all of a sudden, people had a real interest in abolitionist thinking and abolitionist organizing. Now, why is she using the term abolitionist? Why is she not saying, yeah, people are really excited about completely banning prisons? Well, because if she said completely banning prisons, you would look at this like, what are you, insane? Like there's violent people out there that murder and steal and hurt children. And yes, they absolutely deserve to be in prison and segregated from the rest of society so they don't hurt innocent people, right? But if you talk about the abolitionist movement, well, now all of a sudden it conjures up images of the abolition of slavery. And that's why that terminology is being used. It's not because it's the best terminology to describe what it is that they're trying to achieve. It's once again conditioning the reader to think about this in a way they want you to think about it, as opposed to the very real world consequences of what happens if these sort of policies actually go into effect. And we see this all the time. In Virginia, they've passed a bunch of laws that are essentially making it easier for violent offenders to get out of jail early. And then to have their records expunged, sometimes automatically expunged. And again, I'm not against criminal justice reform. I've carried criminal justice reform bills. I think there's definitely a place for it. But we're supposed to do it in such a way that also takes into account the considerations of the victims, their families, and just society at large that isn't breaking laws and would like to be able to live in peace. Because the less assurance you have that you're living in a peaceful society with reasonable law and order, the less likely you are to engage in productive social and economic activity, which is beneficial for all society. But again, when we've got movements now, serious movements that are talking about completely getting rid of the prison system or defunding the police, that's cause for serious concern. And when they couch it in these sorts of terms, that is what, you know, again, if you wonder why so many college students are coming home and regurgitating things that the most of us look at and go, that's absurd. Well, again, if it's been couched in abolitionist language, who wants to be anti-abolitionist, right? So again, it's not a well-reasoned argument. It's using sophistry, right? It's using sophistry as a debate tactic to reorient the way you think about it. Now, listen, there's nothing wrong with sharing a different perspective or a different sort of analysis or even different wording on a particular topic to get people to understand what it is that you're trying to say. But when you're not being totally honest about what you're going to do, that's problematic. And again, using this sort of language is very intentional. And you see the same thing with defunding the police. There was a story put out by Hayes Brown I think this was also MSNBC, where there was a debate going on in the Senate where they were talking about, you know, defunding the police. And you had a lot of Republican senators essentially saying, wow, that's fascinating, because here we are with a bunch of National Guardsmen and new walls and barriers set up all around the Capitol and a new influx of police. You know, that seems a little disingenuous that, okay, yeah, you want more police protection here, but you don't want to offer police protection within those communities that were affected all summer long, or just communities in general that suffer from high crime rates. And, you know, Hayes Brown said that this is a red herring argument, all right? And red herring is a logical fallacy where it essentially says that you're comparing two things that can't be compared, or you're trying to get off the topic of what we're discussing by coming up with something that is superficially comparable, but not really comparable when you look at the underlying propositions that we're discussing. And his whole argument was essentially that you know, defunding a police because of police brutality is not the same as taking something like the Capitol riots and recognizing that there is a legitimate function for police within that area. Okay, fair enough. The problem is I don't think he's actually giving a fair hearing to the people that are making the argument with respect to the Capitol riots. And I, this is something that's been really frustrating to me, is there's so much Democrat emphasis on this was an assault on the symbol of our democracy, the very Capitol building. Okay, I don't argue with that. I don't disagree that was egregious and it deserves to be punished, and that police protection is necessary in order to make sure that something like that doesn't occur, right? I agree with all of that. Here's what I don't understand. Yes, you have instances of police brutality, but you're now suggesting that if you have an instance of police brutality, then defunding the police is an appropriate mechanism in order to address that. I would say that's a non sequitur fallacy. It doesn't necessarily follow unless you're going to present a good argument on why fewer police or less police pay is actually contributing to less crime, not less convictions, right? It's really easy. If you want to get less crime from a legal perspective, great, legalize everything, and now you don't have any more crime, right? But that's not why we pass laws against certain behaviors. We pass laws against certain behaviors like theft or fraud or murder or rape, because we don't want those things to occur. We want to disincentivize them, and then we want to punish the people that act in that way in order to prevent them from doing it again. We pass those laws in order to protect innocent people. So again, please explain how defunding the police is an appropriate way or a logical way to address police brutality. Now, if you wanted to say we need more funding in order to take law enforcement through additional education or training, okay, that makes sense to me logically. I can follow that line of reasoning. But, you know, again, it's this whole idea that when they attack the Capitol, we want more police. But when they burn down a minority-owned business in an inner-city neighborhood, we're not as furious about that. I got news for you. The real symbol of who we are as a people is not found in the Capitol. It's found in everyday America. And they are everyday Americans are every bit as worthy of police protection as the people that go represent us up on Capitol Hill. And it is mind-boggling to me that the same people that want to defund the police at a local level for whatever reason are absolutely convinced that more guns, more cops, more soldiers, more barriers, more walls are absolutely necessary and appropriate at the Capitol building, because that's a symbol of our democracy. Well, I would argue that someone that works their entire life building a small business, you know, in a neighborhood that their entire life is poured into it, that is also a symbol of our democracy. And by the way, we live in a constitutional republic, right? But I don't want to mince words here, right? Let's just talk about what they're doing. So I just find that absolutely insulting. So again, if you want to make a good argument for defunding the police, well then yes, I think it is totally fair to bring up the Democrats' response to January 6th and the response after January 6th. Because I don't think calling in for additional police support was an inappropriate response when there's a genuine concern about additional criminal activity or even potentially terrorist activity. Right, but let's also say that when you have a high crime neighborhood, going in and saying we're going to defund the police because a relatively small percentage of bad actors within the police force have done something wrong. Again, I don't think that is that does not logically follow to me. Again, perfectly willing to hear the argument, but for him to call this out as a red herring, or to suggest that and one of the arguments he used was, well, the people storming the Capitol were largely white and they don't deal with the same power imbalances, so it's not the same thing. Let's assume for a second that that is absolutely correct. Okay. I think there's certain things that are problematic about that reasoning, especially on the whole power imbalance argument that we're having in this country nowadays. It's not to say that I think it's completely invalid, but I do think that there's certainly some logical problems and inconsistencies with it. But then, okay, explain to me the power imbalance at the Capitol. So when you know, predominantly white people did something illegal, more police is appropriate. But in an inner city where the victims are predominantly minorities, more police are not appropriate? Again, how does that follow? I don't understand the reasoning. And I've read a lot of articles. I've heard the arguments coming from the other side on this. Unfortunately, I think that they use a lot of terminology that sets people off to automatically basically come to their conclusion before we actually read the data. And that's what I saw in both of these articles with respect to abolishing prisons and more efforts to defund the police. Let's talk about some other articles that showed up, MSNBC and CNN, where they were talking about Senate confirmation hearings. So there was a big dust up over Neera Tanden, who President Biden is wants to put into cabinet position with respect to the budget office. And you go back and you look at her tweets. Now, she deleted a whole host of tweets where she was calling Mitch McConnell Moscow Mitch, and she was talking about how horrible Ted Cruz was. Basically, a lot of very, very partisan and hyper-partisan arguments, using a lot of, you know, perverse language and things like that. You know, all the sort of things that Democrats have continually told us was horrible about Donald Trump. What I find interesting about this is that when even... you know, the Democrat Senator Manchin from West Virginia said, yeah, I don't think this is appropriate. I think President Biden should pick someone else for this position because they're going to be serving in what is essentially a nonpartisan environment where senators and members of Congress have to be able to rely on the information that they're putting out with respect to the budget. And it's hard to do that when you're now going to call these people for testimony. And it's very, very obvious that they're hyper-partisan nominees. Now, we can argue all day long on whether or not Republicans and Democrats both do this. I think they do. But the argument was, is that, look, you can't sit here and talk about unity and then pick someone for an ostensibly nonpartisan position and then not expect their tweets to be something that is considered. But the argument that came out, and some Democrats made that argument. They're like, oh, yeah, you Republicans, now you're worried about tweets. You know, you didn't seem to be all that worried about it when it was President Trump. Okay, that's a fair argument. You can make that argument. But they immediately went into, well, this is sexist, right? And you, Senator Manchin was asked about this. Like, is this sexism on, because she's a woman, and therefore, if you have any problems with her sitting in or being a part of this cabinet, then therefore it must be sexism, which is driving your motivation. And here's what's interesting. Again, did they come up with any arguments, any rational arguments based off of Senate testimony, based off of things that were said either, you know, during a confirmation hearing or public on Twitter? Did they come up with any sort of evidence that would suggest that the reason why people had a problem with this particular nominee was that because she was a woman? No, because they don't feel they need to, right? They can just make the charge of sexism, and because nobody wants to be accused of sexism, all of a sudden it's this backpedaling, right? They automatically put you on the defense. Look, if you want to accuse someone of sexism, here's all I ask. Can you present some sort of information, some sort of evidence that goes beyond the fact that the nominee that is being heard happens to be a woman? And by the way, this is coming from the same political party that essentially thinks that there's, you know, an infinite number of genders and somebody can identify one way or the next from one day to the next, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? But then when a woman comes forward, it's like it's automatically sexism. If you have any problems with her past statements or her ability to be objective when it's analyzing the budget, you know, again, I would have loved to have seen the corresponding articles from the left, from MSNBC, from CNN, when it was a female Trump appointee or when it was a Trump appointee that was a person of color, right? Did you see any articles automatically assuming that if Democrats opposed them, then clearly it was because they were a person of color or because of their sex? No, you didn't see that. Of course you didn't see that. Because the presumption from left-wing media outlets is Democrats, they're fine. Republicans are all secret closet bigots, right? And so obviously if they do that, we have to immediately ask the question of whether or not this was driven by sexism or racism. But we never have to address that question with Democrats. Again, the standard is not equal. And they would suggest to you that's because of the way that Republicans behave and Democrats behave. I think that's nonsense. And again, you're seeing now where it doesn't even apply to some people within their own party. And you saw this as well. There was another article that said Republicans are targeting some of President Biden's cabinet nominees. Most notably, the nominees of color are facing outsized opposition. Okay, again, if you look at the Senate testimony and if you look at the issues that they brought up, Republicans were treating every Senate nominee essentially the same. They were looking at past statements. They were looking at their positions on issues in order to determine whether or not that is someone that they would want to fill a cabinet position. So they were treating people equally, right? I didn't hear one senator even insinuate that the real reason why they had a problem with this person was because of their skin color or their gender. Not, I didn't hear one person say that. They all came up with, again, reasonable concerns. And if those reasonable concerns were disproportionately with some person, well, now who's the person focusing on race? Is it the right or is it the left? But again, it is totally low-hanging fruit from the left to engage in this sort of intellectually dishonest behavior that they never apply to their own side. And again, that's because William F. Buckley Jr. said it best once. He goes, "We think they're wrong, they think we're evil." And you see that manifesting itself in the sort of reporting going on with respect to these Senate confirmation hearings. So, you know, again, I got no problem with a reporter doing some deep digging or some analysis to come back and say, well, no, the reason why I'm questioning this particular senator's opposition is because he said this on this date, or because, you know, he carried legislation that was, you know, clearly bigoted. No, they're not doing any of that. It's just a general assumption that if you're a member of the GOP and you have a problem with a particular candidate, no matter how good an argument that you make, it must be racially driven. And I'll give you a perfect example of something that happened just today in the General Assembly. We had a report that came out about the parole board in Virginia. And this parole board has been making some horrible decisions with respect to who they release from prison. And when we first looked for, there was an inspector general report on the parole board and the procedures and were they properly following the procedures? Were they being objective? And the first report we got was a 6-page report and there was a lot of redactions. So we fought for an unredacted report. We got a 6-page report back. Well, it turns out that it was actually a 13-page report, and that 13-page report by the inspector general suggested that there was a number of potential violations of law, like actual, you know, violations of civil law, in some cases, you know, misdemeanor level offenses that resulted in people getting released from jail that had murdered people. Right. And we brought this up and said, look, this is a problem. It's a problem of transparency, first of all, because we asked for the inspector general report. They dragged their feet and it turns out we didn't even get the full report initially. Now we finally have the full report and we find out that a lot of our concerns about what the parole board was doing and how they were behaving were potentially founded. And we have an obligation to do something about that, not least of which because the former chair of the parole board is now a judge. She just got voted in as a judge this session. And her deputy is now heading up the parole board. And so when we brought this up and said, this is cause for concern, both from a transparency perspective and for whether or not we actually continue to keep these people in positions of public trust. What was the response back? You're racist, right? Like, just once. I would like for a standard to be applied equally. And if you don't like the argument that we're making, great. Make a counter argument that doesn't automatically have to inject race into a situation for which we weren't even taking that into account. It was, the report said that these people did these things, right? Or alleged to do these things. That requires additional investigation because the decisions coming out of the parole board were not very good. But nope, we're going to couch the entire argument in race. And don't tell me you actually believe in combating racism when you use it as essentially a foil to attempt to shut down argument. That isn't about argument. That's about if you don't do what we say, if you don't vote the way we want, or if you dare speak up when you identify a very reasonable problem or concern, we're going to shame, intimidate, or humiliate you into silence. And I gotta thank Delegate Todd Gilbert. He did a great job talking about this and laying out the very reasonable concerns. But again, the response we get back is not good argumentation. It's not saying, you know what, Delegate Gilbert, I don't agree with your analysis, but this is something that we should look into. No, 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 none of that. It's the constant insinuation that you're an evil, mean-spirited, racist, bigoted person, and so therefore we shouldn't listen to your concerns. Again, that's what I'm talking about, is when people are using these terms, not as a way to foster debate or discussion, but as a way to shut it down, what are you hiding? What are you hiding at that point? Because the truth doesn't need to be afraid. Good argumentation is good argumentation, regardless of what side of the aisle it comes from. And during this session, there has been argumentation that I have seen coming from the left that has been good argumentation. But unfortunately, what I've seen is when we respond with any sort of problem of what they're saying next, it's immediately going to again, it's either race, it's sexism, it's bigotry, and they don't feel any need to prove it. And the reason why is because what we just talked about today with respect to the way that the media covers it. They know the media will simply parrot their talking points without actually digging in to the underlying assumptions, the evidence about what has happened, what hasn't happened. I'm so sick of hearing the left talking about how much they love science. Really. Really. Because what I see is a party that loves the banner of science. They love the legitimacy that referencing science provides. And again, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because I do have Democrat colleagues, and I have seen reporters on the left that have used the term science appropriately and have recognized that it is an analytical process. But for too many others, what it is a magical talisman, right? They have reduced science to mysticism with the way that they actually use it in political discourse. Where now it's just, if I just attach the word science onto whatever argument I'm making, poof, it's relevant. Or it's a good argument. And again, it's another, we are watering down terms through our political discourse that should hold a certain degree of respect within society. But when you constantly use them purely for political purposes, as opposed to taking them seriously and using them as standards by which we can judge behavior or action or policy, you are doing a disservice for the very thing you claim to care about. And unfortunately, that's been on wide display within political discourse. And again, the news articles that we've just read off and the way that they're actually talking about these things encourages. Again, it's not encouraging debate. It's not encouraging multiple perspectives to an idea so that we can arrive at truth or mutually agreed upon terms. It's about manipulating the terms, again, in order to humiliate and intimidate people from actually speaking. And that's really problematic. Let's talk about one of the things. This is a little bit different, but it's along the same lines. I just think it's important because the minimum wage came up with respect to talk about the stimulus bill. And again, you see some of the sophistry involved here with how does legislation get done in Washington, D.C., or really any legislature for that matter. So one of the things that they put into the stimulus was a $15 minimum wage increase. And so now this is a tactic where you put something in the bill that you know a lot of your colleagues can't vote for. And then when they don't vote for the bill because of that, you automatically say they're against the whole bill, right? Again, it's another logical fallacy. Where you're treating opposition on one point as if it's opposition to the whole thing. And we call these poison pills, right? They put on a poison pill because if they know they put it in there, now they can run on a political issue that goes beyond the poison pill, right? So if you wanted to run on a $15 minimum wage, great, run on a $15 minimum wage. They don't really want to do that. They want to put it into a stimulus package. And now anybody that would have voted for that stimulus package that now feels like they can't, because of minimum wage policy, now they're going to accuse him of opposing any sort of stimulus, right? It's the whole argument, if you don't do everything I want, then you don't want to do anything I want. And it's intellectually dishonest. Now, I will say this. There is a reasonable argument to be made that when a bill has certain components to it, where a bill is addressing one thing, and then there's what we call like accompanying components, which is to say that if you want to address this, you're also going to have to address some of these other things. Now, in Virginia, we actually have pretty good germaneness rules. And this is one issue that I am very passionate about, the whole concept of one issue per bill. Now, obviously, one bill can address a lot of things, but it needs to address only the things that are relevant to why the bill was dropped in the first place. Why was it actually presented in the first place? That's not what they do in Washington, D.C. It's pretty much wide open. So that's why you see all this additional spending within the stimulus bill that has nothing to do with what I think the average citizen would consider to be, a reasonable or a relevant stimulus spending. That's why they throw millions of dollars at the Kennedy Arts and Entertainment Center up there in Washington, D.C. in a package that was meant to go to people that are suffering as a result of, being unemployed from their small business or businesses shutting down, et cetera. And again, some people might ask, was it really that big a deal, right? People are suffering, just vote for it. Why is the minimum wage such a big deal? I'm going to explain why. Because if part of the reason why you're doing this stimulus, and I'm just going to be honest with you, I have a real problem with government stimulus because ultimately it's taking money away from taxpayers and then giving it back. But it's in the way that the government wants to spend it as opposed to the way individuals would spend it. But let's just say for a second that you support the stimulus bill and you're wondering why the minimum wage is a poison pill. Part of the whole reason for the stimulus, the stated reason for the stimulus, was making sure that small businesses, which comprise the majority of jobs within the country, don't go out of business as a result of all of the lockdown provisions that we see state by state. If you now come in and tell that same small business that you are now required, and they've tried to put provisions in there to protect certain small businesses, but not others, let's just say business in general. If you now tell them that you have to pay $15 an hour for a job that the work that is being produced doesn't produce $15 an hour of actual productivity, you're now telling a business you have to pay someone more than what their labor is actually worth. And the end result is they hire low-skilled labor. Right, you'll see a lot of Republicans argue that this is bad for the economy, it's bad for small business. That is all true. Let me tell you one of the primary reasons I oppose the minimum wage increases. It's because it's bad for low-skilled labor. Because if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, obviously it's a little bit different right now because of COVID, but typically on average, less than 3% of the labor force actually makes minimum wage. Right? And most of the people making minimum wage, It's not the mother of four trying to, feed her family, right? That's always the narrative that they pull out. But that's not really what it is. It's usually people 25 or under. They're working their way through college. Maybe they're working part-time. It's the high school student with their first job as a barista, right? That's the person that is typically making minimum wage. So when we talk about minimum wage, we're talking about less than 3% of the labor force. Usually younger people. Sometimes it is older people that have Social Security and they're augmenting their Social Security. In some situations, it's not someone that desperately needs the job to feed their family. They're getting that job for extra income, or it is a lower income family and that is an extra job that is helping pay for the family. It's not as if the minimum wage job is the sole job that they are relying on to raise the family. That is not borne out in any of the figures or statistics that we have. Are there individual cases of that? Sure. Right, but it is a minuscule portion of the overall labor force. And what you're essentially doing, right? Even, let's say you don't care how much of the labor force is making minimum wage. You don't want anyone to live under those conditions. Okay, great. Here's what you just did. You just encourage every business that has the ability to do so to fire low-skilled laborers and replace them with automation. That's what you've done, because their labor is no longer competitive within the marketplace. And you can make whatever emotional appeal that you want that, well, this isn't just about, labor. This is about real people. Yeah, I agree. It's about real people. So here's an idea. Don't take away the only job opportunities that they actually have. Don't incentivize the marketplace to replace low-skilled labor with machines so that a politician can feel better about the policy that they're advocating for. That is the real world consequence. And you see this all over the place. If you look at the different countries that have instituted significantly higher minimum wage laws, what you see is significantly higher youth unemployment, because those are the people that are most affected by minimum wage laws. And the longer that young person is kept out of the marketplace because people are not willing to assume the risk or the cost of hiring them, the longer it takes them to actually build the work experience that they need in order to move up the economic ladder. And so you're not just hurting them in the moment where they can't get the job, you are setting them up for failure in the future. Because here's the other statistic that the people that love to talk about minimum wage don't want to tell you about. The vast majority of people on minimum wage are young and will be off minimum wage within a relatively short period of time, provided that they show up to their job on time. That's the reality. How do I know this? I made minimum wage. And within, I think it was 3 months, I was no longer making minimum wage anymore. Why? Because I showed up with no job experience. I showed up with no skills, but within 3 to 6 months, I had skills. I knew what I was doing. And there was a natural incentive within the marketplace for the employer to pay me more because I could have taken those skills somewhere else. But if you don't let that young person develop the skills in the first place, you're putting their entire economic development on hold. You're diminishing it. And the older they get without being able to build that work experience, the less likely they are to be able to move up the economic ladder. So, you know, good job. Good job to everybody that decided that they were just going to arbitrarily pass something like this without understanding the very real economic consequences, not just for small business, not just for the economy in general, but for those people that most desperately need that entry-level position. Right? So that's the reason. If you're wondering why the minimum wage creates such a poison pill for this overall stimulus package, that's the reason. That's the reason why so many of us have a problem with it. All right. So it's getting very frustrating. And I know, you know, the people watching this share that frustration as well. The people listening to share that frustration as well, because ultimately, you know, again, if you could have heard, because I've given this argument before on minimum wage, I've given this argument before on law enforcement, I've given the argument before on voting rights. And I would like to think that I generally present my facts in a logical and intellectually consistent fashion. And it is easy to convince me that I'm wrong. You just have to show up with better facts, better evidence, and a good argument. Because ultimately what I'm after is the truth. That's what I want. I want to be on the side of truth. I want to be on the side of truth more than I want to be on the side of my political party. I want to be on the side of truth. So just present a good argument. But more and more what we're seeing is, again, it's the use of sophistry. It's the use of bad argumentation. And it is done so for the purpose of shutting down debate, not fostering it. And if we can't actually have this honest debate, here's what's going to end up happening. People will become more and more frustrated. And they're going to start to lose faith in the overall deliberative process that we have with respect to our government, with respect to the peaceful adjudication of problems. And so we all need to take it upon ourselves. And this goes for the right too, because believe me, I have seen some horrible argumentation on the right and it drives me nuts. We have an obligation, if we really believe in a free society, if we believe in freedom of inquiry, then we all have an obligation to look beyond the sort of sophistic language and narratives that we see and find other people of goodwill and foster those conversations. I'm going to be going on a left-wing podcast. I've been on there once before. I'm going to go on there again. And one of the things I really respect about how they conduct their podcast is we have very different viewpoints, but they're always very respectful and they let me share my opinions in context. I listen to their opinions and positions in context. And we try to find the areas where we actually have some common grounds of agreement. Right. And it's not all the time. It's not even a lot of the time. But what I found is that when you can have that honest conversation, when you're not instantly trying to demonize the other person or assuming that if they disagree with you, it's automatically because of negative or ill intent. You can actually find areas of agreement to work together. And perhaps even most importantly, you can find areas where you agree to disagree. And you can make the additional argument that, look, if we really disagree on this, maybe politics isn't the best way to solve it. Maybe the best way to solve it is to allow free people to live and let live, make their own decisions, learn from the results of those decisions, and make better ones in the future. Thank you again for joining us today on Making the Argument. I also wanted, again, shameless plug. If you haven't checked out The Why Minutes yet, you can go to thewhyminutes.com. We're also on Facebook, on YouTube. Go check out those videos. One of the things that we really try to do in those videos is talk about issues and policies while sharing interesting stories, interesting insights. And again, it's not partisan. It's more about just discussing ideas in a way that really tries to, again, foster that sense of inquiry and really fostering how do we defend and advance the cause of a free society. So please go to thewineminutes.com, check that out. Also, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, if you listen on Spotify, if you've got this up on your phone right now, here's what I'm asking you to do. As soon as you're in a safe place, if you're driving, don't do this while you're driving. Go on there, you know, hit a 5-star review, write a little review for us. I just saw some more comments come in that have asked us some questions. We're going to be actually picking those up in one of our future podcasts. So if you want to influence the way that this podcast, not only the reach that we have, but the content that we talk about, that's a great way to do it. And we certainly appreciate it. So once again, thank you for joining us and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.